All right, folks, settle down, settle down. Yes, it's me, Mr. Star, okay? And I'm back again to talk about something that finally makes sense, okay? A little bit of classic rock, the golden age, all right? I'm here with my good friend and my early kind of, I don't know, I want to say Padawan to get in the good gracious of the kids, but I'm here with my good friend AG.
Hey, it's so good to be in the same room again. I mean, I know face masks, obviously, and all that shit.
But, right, you know. Right. Both tested, both totally, both clean, both tested negative. You know, you got to stay safe out there. Got to have the masks on. AG, it's good to see you. It's been a long time.
Yeah, too long. But, you know, I mean, you really brought everything together with, I mean, Apple Guild for starters. I mean, the Battle of the Band is sort of my highlight, and you know, it's hard to even articulate the influence on, you know, Apple, especially 7G, all that, you know. So I mean, thanks so much for being here.
No, of course. You know, it took time out of my busy schedule. As you know, I'm busy building and proceeding to play and shred guitars these days. You know, really getting back to the hardcore of rock and roll. And it's just been great. You know, I know we had a little bit of a falling out and a falling in and a falling up and a falling down.
But that's what this music's about, you know, like without that kind of live, that drama, like how would these recordings even happen?
So right. Like, I mean, drama, love, rock and roll, you know. Do you even need to say more? We could end it right there, you know.
I'm into that.
We could end it right there. So we're here specifically in conversation about classic rock. Now it's funny, we were talking before we hit the big red button about classic rock, about 69 to 71, you know. You want to say 30 years ago. You can't say that anymore, you know. We're talking closer to 50 years ago, some of this stuff.
Half of a
millennium?
Yeah.
Half a millennium ago. Who would have thunk, you know? Pretty surreal stuff.
And these years, you know, 1969 to 1971, it's, you know, obviously rock and roll is happening before and after that, but undoubtedly the golden age, you know. It's just like,
yeah, I think it's a bit of an unspoken kind of thing, you know. It's, you can just you know, close your eyes, think of rock and roll, the numbers 1969 a dash and then 1971 appear before your eyes. So that's just kind of we don't even need to bring it up. We could have just said classic rock and everyone knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, everyone would have just, yeah, exactly.
So I guess we could start with 69 if we want to get real.
That's logical, for sure.
Makes sense. Bit of a warm up. Now, I mean, I feel like it's obvious. I mean, we got to talk about the Beatles. We got to talk about those four cheeky boys from Liverpool, right?
Yeah, Abbey and Road, you know.
Exactly. 69 kicked it off, Abbey Road.
And it's insane because, you know, I grew up fairly near the, like, Abbey Road crossing, you know.
Oh, really?
Which is, yeah. I mean, near enough, like a long walk away, you know. You'd have to, like, cross the road, obviously, but you'd be right there. And
right.
I don't know, like, it was definitely very formative. I remember always thinking about it, like seeing all the names, different bands scribbled on the front. Like, I think most of the PC roster has been written on that wall at some point, you know, by
right,
me, other
right.
people.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, it's crazy because Abbey Road was initially my favorite. Like, I'm pretty into the White Album, maybe Revolver, you know. But I don't know, Abbey Road, it became special to me. I just specifically remember, I think I was about 18 or just turned 19, and they're doing the, like, the 2009, you know, stereo remaster, right? Like, finally. And right, I was just they sort of knew me from being around, and, you know, I was already a bit of the name, you know, in a kind of like Denmark Street, like, rock vibes. And
right,
yeah,
right.
I was doing the remaster.
I guess 09 was right around when we met first as well.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, like, exactly.
Kind of, mentoring, but I think I just did, you know.
Maybe so, jamming's a good way.
Yeah, you know, it was loose, it was fun, it was 09, you know.
And you know, I was, you know, I think I was too shy to tell you about this at the time, but yeah, I think it was George Martin's son, what's his name, you know, who was in charge of the 2009 stereo remaster. And yeah, I was just like, I was sort of in the area, got invited in because they sort of knew me just a tiny bit. And it was crazy hearing all those stems for the first time in this kind of isolated way, and like the kind of off mic laughing and stuff. And like, you know,
massive. I mean, some of the stems were only about, I don't know, 1 or 2 seconds long, but were held on close to 100 feet of tape. And
I know,
so they were bringing in each song, you know, would fill the whole room. These stems were just massive.
Yeah, and Abbey Road is way, way bigger than people think, just specifically for that reason, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of, you know, we're talking about late 60s, you know, end of summer love kind of stuff, you know, and it's literally, it's like, it's almost like an Absurdist album. It's literally, it's like, it starts off with Come Together, which is like the most wild opener of all time. It's like you have young kids in their 20s talking about toe jam football, and you know, it's just like coming out so hard with these crazy lines.
I find it hard to listen to because it's just so good, you know, like it makes me feel terrible about my own music.
The writing on that song is so frustrating. It's like every time I listen, I'm like, god damn, that could have been me. 69, I was writing funky stuff, but not that funky. No monkey fingers in my song, you know.
Exactly, yeah, I can't imagine.
But yeah, I mean, I used to be into, you know, Sergeant Pepper. I used to, my boys used to call me the Pepper Man. When I used to pick up the guitar, they go, Pepper Man, play that song, and I would play.
Yeah, what's the worst that could happen, right?
Exactly, what's the worst that could happen? And then as I've gotten older, listen to more Beatles songs. I listen to one Beatles song a year, as you know, it's my rule. And I just, you know, got through Abbey Road, and it's just a, it's a special.
This is the thing. Look, Abbey Road, you know, it wasn't really up in the pantheon for me initially, and it was hard for me to even understand. This is possibly before aux cables were even like a big thing.
Yeah,
you know,
I heard, maybe this is a rumor, but I heard you used to go in with an iPod, and they would take your iPod at the door, plug it into a machine, and start running out tape of all the songs, and then you'd walk away with the tape.
I mean, that was more if you had a mini disc. I mean, at that time, the whole legal battle between Apple, the label, and Apple, the computer company, wasn't resolved at all. I mean, we all know how long it took for this stuff to get. I mean, I know you don't like streaming, but you know, it took a long time to get the Beatles out. And same way, just no iPods in Abbey Road. I mean, it was crazy.
Hey, listen, you know what I always say? Enough of this cloud. Enough of these streams. I'm not trying to go outside. I'm trying to sit in my hi-fi room. It's me, Neil Diamond, and we're listening to that high quality stuff. You know, I won't get into it. I won't get into it. That's for another time. Another time. You know.
But you know, like, I mean, I don't think there's many bands that even some of that ethos as well as Zepp, right? You know.
Oh, of course. I mean, Zeppelin too. The same year.
How can you believe it? I mean, I can't believe it because I wasn't around at that time. But
oh,
Abbey
man.
Road. And Zep 2, same year, Led Zeppelin 2. I mean, what's going on?
True. I remember the first time I heard, what's my biggest favorite one on there? It's got to be Ramble On. I mean, it starts so soft. You have these jangly acoustics, and then it gets so hard with this electric, just marriage of acoustic and electric guitars. It's just, it's next level.
I mean, I'm more of a Whole Lot of Love guy.
Like, right. Of
obviously, there's that riff.
I can't deny it.
And then, you know, the drum solo that they just break into, you know,
it's
just Bonham, and then it's a drum solo break, and then this sort of like frenzied, orgasmic screaming. I mean, it's pretty obvious that the influence that had on something like Number One Angel, Pop 2, Hey Cutie, even juxtaposition. I don't know if I could have thought of that without that amazing drum to vocal transitions.
I mean, I always said, especially that era when you were working on those tunes, I always like, yeah, that's Jimmy Page Jr. over there. You know, he's taking a page at a Pages book. You know, I like to joke. You know, I like to joke.
It's not even a joke. You know, I'm surprised I didn't get busted. I mean, sometimes I just Shazam that and I just get fucking Zep 2 back. You know.
It's I mean,
ridiculous.
That whole thing was written on tour, which always blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds live though, right? It's like a live.
Exactly. I mean, they're literally touring some amazing stuff. And then when they're not playing the shows, they're writing this Zeppelin 2. It's so full of energy. It's like they're carrying that live performance straight into the album.
And you know, for someone like me who grew up with like click tracks and that kind of stuff, like hearing like the Heartbreaker riff, you know, like whatever tempo it needs to be, you know, whatever it needs. It's like, is it rock? Is it blues?
That's the thing. It's loose. You know, it's loose. It blends around, you know, it's like that's the type of streaming I'm talking about. Like if you're in an inner tube floating down a river, you know?
Exactly.
It's gonna pick up, it's gonna slow down. Best thing about tape.
It's an instrument, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, if you're talking about, as I like to call it, concrete music, but as the French call it, something else, but
le,
I like...
Le musique concrète avec... avec une, I don't know, I forgot the French term.
Give me a reel-to-reel and a drumstick, put any song on there, I'll play that thing like a Bach concerto, you know.
But that, yeah, like, you know, 69, you got those albums that are, you know, like Abbey Road, Led Zeppelin 2, like clearly pretty much live takes. And then you have something like In the Court of the Crimson King, like King Crimson, yeah. Same year. And, you know, I mean, I think it's live, but how can it be? You know, it's just so tight.
It was just the practice that these bands, I mean, all of them, the Beatles, Zeppelin, King Crimson, they're going in day after day after day. And it's just, it doesn't matter if you see them live. Doesn't matter if you, whatever it is, you know, they're just so sharp. Speaking of tape. That album, they did like re-releases in the 90s and stuff, and it all sounded like crap. And then they found the original masters in like 2004 or something.
Damn, so, it's called The Crimson King.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that makes sense, because it came up on Spotify again, sounding totally different. Yeah.
They found the masters, and I mean, we're talking about tape here. And some of those tapes still didn't have some of the transitions and stuff printed on them yet, because a lot of that was printed in later cuts. So surreal.
Amazing. I mean, that first track, you know, people probably know it from like Kanye West, you know, the 21st Century Schizoid Man. I didn't love how he used that. It's too obvious. But I mean, I used to play along to that riff, you know, dun 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 dun. Like, I mean, that was me all the time. Like, I mean, a few weeks into playing guitar, just pretty much just playing that riff, like, you know, note for note, admittedly, but like pretty much one riff.
You've always been a bit of a pro, you know. You hear something, I remember putting, I think I was the one who showed you that Crimson album, and I remember you just listened to it for a second, all of a sudden I hear you from the other room, and you're just, you know, note for note, beat to beat, just perfectly.
You know what I figured out years later, right? Like way more recently. So the guitarist, King Crimson, Robert Fripp, you know, his own tuning, new standard tuning.
Oh, yeah.
So I played it in like, I played it like old standard, right? First, like classic EAD, GBE type stuff. I tuned it to his, you know, new standard, right? Low C, G, D, A, G, right? Like kind of fifths, like kind of like classical violin. And then I'm like, damn, this riff is basically open strings. It's just like basically strumming, not even moving your left hand. And then the whole thing's just there, which is, how did I miss that? It's crazy.
It's so funny too, because especially in some of the older clips of him, when he was getting into that, the Frippetronics thing, when like he was like setting up those single tapes and doing the loops and stuff, you see some of the solos he's doing and the movements he's doing over some of those tape performances, and it's like, you know, that hand's barely moving. You know, he's got it set just how he likes it.
I mean, Frippetronic, I mean, that's the Frippetronic stuff, that's only really good stuff that's still happening in like the 70s and 80s. Like, it's the only good thing on Bowie, you know, any of that stuff. Yeah. Like, it's just,
I assume a lot of the Frippetronic stuff really influenced you as well, and some of the things that you were working on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I think probably he was exposed to that first, and then that's, you know, that's how he probably got talking about 1969 and the Court of the Crimson King.
Right.
So, Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about, I mean, that stuff was so clean. But if we want to talk about clean, we got to talk about Captain Beefheart, Trout Mask Replica. Because that, I didn't know this until recently, but all of those, everything instrumental on that album was recorded in 6 hours.
We rehearsed for a year, right? Which is, that's how it should be, you know?
And hit to the studio and just boom, done. You know,
I mean, that's kind of how it was with my AG Nord disc from 7G, honestly. It was like a year of just rehearsing, just no sequencing. Like, I know you don't love that synth that much, you know. I
can understand.
It was crazy. The only way to really get it sound like I wanted to was just to practice for like a year, you know, like kind of like cult-like. And then, yeah, pretty maybe 6 hours, maybe less, maybe 7 hours, can't remember. And then it's just, yeah, it's on there, you know, which is, it's a...
Practice, and I think it's good that you did that. I think practice is a is an art in itself. Whether or not people are hearing the practice or it's documented or people know how much you did it, repetition is the father of learning. And just the practice... is the art form for the person creating the art. You know, that is the beginning of the artistry that you eventually
get. Yeah, that's their experience. No, that's just how... Man, I gotta say, I don't know if I told you this anecdote either, but I mean, I remember, I don't know when it was, maybe 06 or something, when I was really getting deep into this album. I mean, I used to get these really bad fevers as a teenager, like especially when I was finishing a deadline or something, like something at school. I mean, you see me in that zone sometimes, kind of like tripping out a bit, but I get these bad fevers, like a wild temperature, and I'd pretty much be hallucinating. And it was this one night where I was like practicing the Trout Mask Replica track, China Pig, on repeat. And that's a kind of like easier, bluesier number, right? I had this really bad fever, and I was just, I just started to believe that I was in Captain Beefheart's magic band during the Trout Mask Replica sessions. I was like convinced in this sort of hallucinatory fever. And I was just so in it, just playing China Pig, like trying to go to bed. I think I thought I was still playing. I think I imagined I was still in those sort of LA sessions. And
it got
so extreme. I ended up throwing up on the captain, like not realizing I had to clean up my bed the next day. Like I literally hallucinated, pushed to the edge of rehearsal, like threw up. I was like so embarrassed. I thought I'd throw up on Captain Beefheart, but it was just all in my mind, you know.
It's something so, I think, you know, if Zappa could hear that, you know, I think when Zappa was producing some of that stuff, I think there is a piece of it, you know, at the time people saying anti-music, this, that, the beginning of blah, 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 blah. But you think when you look back, now it's like the Van Gogh of rock albums, you know, it like literally took so long for it to hit this massive critical acclaim. But with that kind of state, I mean, you think of some of these the buzzwords now the kid who does the polyrhythms, but polyrhythms, we're talking about really complex structured rock songs. And I think like what you said, that almost trance-like meditative state you can get when you pick up a guitar, just you and a guitar, working through some of these solos.
I mean, this is the blueprint from like, you know, from like math rock to like Jacob Collier or whatever, you know, like,
Collier, that's the one.
Like his right, that I could tell. I know you kind of like that kid, even though you don't want to admit it. It's a bit hard for me to get into, honestly.
He can play instruments.
Yeah, he can, you know. It's a little bit, you know, like, I don't know what I make of that. Like, it's sometimes too much of a straight Ripper Trout Mask, if I'm honest, and... which is my main gripe with it. You know, it sort of sounds like, if you know, it's like music on automatic, you know what I mean? It's just like if you tick the boxes, you know, like chords, changes, reharmonization, like, you know, practice, some of that stuff. It's just like, okay, it was done in 69, like where are we now?
Exactly. And I find that very interesting with kind of this like anti-music sentiment in Captain Beefheart stuff, because you know I've dabbled with some of the new pop music these days. You know, you put me onto a lot of cool new stuff. Do you think there's a connection there with Trout Mask and like obviously you have the Collier influence, but also like a new kind of abstract pop music in the past, like you know, 10 years or so. You see
totally. I mean, you know, I was looking at like the Tramos replica cover. I was looking at the Hot Rats cover by Zappa. I think also 69, by the way. I don't know if we have time to get into that, but like I was looking at those images, let alone the music. And I was like, this is just a 100 Gex album cover, like, but literally, yeah. Like Zappa in a like a drainage with the name Hot Rats. Like, what are we talking about here? Like Captain Beefheart, the captain, like holding a trout mask, like, and just in a hat, like that big hat. Are we joking? You know,
it is that kind of fun, you know, a little bit more complex, but at the same time, you can make it the same way you can make the conversation that, in my belief, you know, 100 Gex is pop music. And it's the same way that I could say that, you know, Captain Beefheart, Trout Mask Replica, it's like it's pop music. There's no way you can't make that discrepancy. It's rock, but that is some good old fashioned pop music right there. That's my kind of pop music, Captain Beefheart.
100%. I mean, you know, so if you think what's going on at the end of 69, you know, I mean, even though it's the golden age, you know, rolling into 1970 and then, you know,
I mean, we got to talk again.
Yeah. I mean, Let It Be, right? Like that's tricky to talk about. I don't know. I mean, it's firmly in the golden age, but it's also just like,
we want to mince words, you know? I knew in 70 when I was bopping around doing my thing from the first song, Two of Us, it just lacks that bite, you know? It just wasn't quite there for me.
I'll say it's not good, right? Like this stupid wall of sound.
It's just
Phil Spector stuff.
It's not right. Phil Spector, it's just, they did it all wrong.
I even think there's some Paul McCartney quote about like the long and winding road, which was something like, I think he called it like an over-seasoned salad or something. And like, he was like, I just wish this long and winding road would end or something. You know, like that was how he felt about that version, which is kind of what led to Let It Be Naked, obviously, in the kind of current era.
And then you think about this long winding road, it's like, it's so obvious as well that it's like, you're talking about this just slodge working through this album, you know? And it's like, what? This triggered, before they did that final show, you know, it's like, didn't George leave for a little bit and then had to come back? And it was like, oh no, to get the spark back, we'll go back to Apple Studios, you know, we'll do the show, but it just wasn't enough, you know? It didn't have that Beatles charm.
And let alone Phil Spector being this, you know, homicidal maniac. Like, you know, if you're gonna be like that and you can't produce, I mean, what? You're just literally like, I don't know. It's ridiculous.
It's a shame. It's a shame because, you know, if I was in Phil Spector's position, I'd say, hey, boys, head on back. You know, go home. We're in no rush, you know? I don't know why they felt like they had to do this.
Or like, let's go to India again. You know, that worked the last time, you know?
Anything else, you know? Let's go have lunch and chat and then maybe not force ourselves to go to the studio over and over again.
I think he represents, so obviously the wall of sound, you know, people think of that as reverb and stuff, but I also see it as like this literal wall between the artist and the producer, you know, this like, that wall of sound is just like separating people. And I hate even thinking about production like that, you know.
That's the beauty of all the stuff that you and all these kids are making now. The immediacy and the closeness of the producer and artist is, I've never seen anything like it. You know, you think about Spector going in there with these four legends, and just because of, like you said, this wall, you know, you could feel,
you
know, it.
He has these four legends and he makes these four walls and he just boxes himself in and it's just a mess, you know.
Perfect analogy right there. And then okay, I guess
so better stuff in 90. Yeah, if we're in 70, there's better stuff that year. It's still a golden age.
Literally, we're talking about the first solo live album of one of the best guitarists of all time. We had Band of Gypsies come out. You know, Hendrix came as this like solo legend. You know.
Yeah. I mean, that's refreshing. You know, right? You know,
at the end. Oh my god.
Yeah. It's amazing. Exactly. I mean, wasn't that even, I think that that show, right? It was recorded January 1st, 1970, wasn't it? This is just like...
Yeah, I think you're right. It literally like kicked off the year.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's kicked off the decade, right? Pretty much, so...
Yeah, true.
It just tells you a lot about that. Like Fillmore East, New York City. I think it's now like a bank or something.
Is it a bank?
Oh man!
I went there to get like a photo, and it was just some like chain bank. I don't know. It was depressing.
That's the worst. I don't like that. I remember 70, that's when, you know, I was pretty decent by 70 on the old six string. But I remember when that came out, I picked up the record, ran home, started listening to it, and very similar to what you were working on with some of that Zappa stuff. You know, I picked up the guitar. I start playing it. I'm going into a transcendental trance. You know, I'm listening to this Hendrix. I'm working on that solo from who knows. I look down, my guitar's on fire. Funnily enough, I think I'm playing the guitar so good that it lit on fire. What really happened is it was a bad outlet. My amp was on fire. My whole apartment was on fire. So I jump out the window. I'm on a first story. It was fun. And I'm looking at this place going up in smoke. But right out of the window, still, the wax is still spinning. Band of Gypsies just blasting out the window.
That's magical. That's magical. I mean, that kind of power, you know, electrical power issue that you have a lot in the US, I think that's what Electric Ladyland was about. I mean, that's a whole other thing. But I mean, that was the name of the studio, the album. Hey, I mean, wait, just quickly, while we're on this, I see someone in the chat, I think I prefer mid-60s to this era.
Who said that?
Mid-60s? Yeah.
No, I said it in the beginning. You know, you close your eyes, you think of classic rock, you think of 69, 70, 71.
I know, you know, because you obviously, there's good music made early in the 60s, but I think it's that moment where it's on the precipice of something, right? It's the end of one decade, the beginning of another, end of summer love, it's getting heavier, the technology is catching up a little bit. The idea of classic rock is starting to form because, you know, before that, it can't really be classic rock. It's just sort of this new thing that's happening. It's like the classic side that's starting to happen, right? It's because of its era.
You know, it's like, I can't get no satisfaction, a classic. But that 65 stuff, you know, around that era, even like, and then you start talking about like, I don't know, like James Brown or something, like Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, great rock songs, and they're classics. But if we're talking about classic rock, 69, 70, 71, you know?
Obvious. I mean, yeah, we should waste time on that. I mean, I guess it's from people who are maybe getting into this genre, who, you know, mainly listen to like hyper pop, glitch playlist stuff, you know?
Yeah. Go, you know, listen. Another great songs, you know, you got the Lil Wayne guitar album. Amazing stuff. That's not classic rock. It's classic and it's rock. But we're talking about the classic rock era, you know? And that's 69 through 71.
And okay, so you know, what's so cool about this era as well is even though you got this super heavy, you know, guitar stuff and rock, you also have albums like Bitches Brew by Miles Davis, right?
That's heavy.
That's pretty much classic rock to me, right?
But it's classic rock. It's kind of like what we're saying earlier. You know, we're not. You can mince words all day. Give me some potatoes. Sit me down with a plate. But if we're talking about classic rock era, even though it's one of the best jazz albums of all time, that is still one of the most legendary classic rock albums ever made. You know, he really rolled his shoulders into it. You know, he's got that rock vibe in those songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it was done with cool as well, right? And like getting, clearly like getting influenced by those other albums, like probably things like Crimson, Beefheart, Zep, you know? So like hearing that stuff and then improvising, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It was so much improv. I mean, that was his whole, he literally, you know, He kind of threw away this whole hoity-toity institution of jazz in it, and funnily enough, made one of the best jazz records ever made. You know,
I forgot the name of the kind of engineer producer, but I mean, he was a legend and essentially was left by Davis with all of this endless tape. I mean, if we were picturing the amount of tape in Abbey Road, just like multiply that by a ridiculous amount. You know, you've got all these guys jamming for weeks with the cord on.
The guy was T.O. Macero, and exactly. That was did the On Pharaoh's Dance. Is that the record? The first one. It's like 19 rolls of tape.
Yeah.
And this guy cut it together, and they're literally looping sometimes like 1 to 5 second sections.
But like, this is the thing, because this is the first like Ableton music, right? Like having the great. I know you don't really know that much about Ableton, but just to explain,
type of soup.
It's kind of. I know you know a bit of Pro Tools. It's kind of like an evolved.
Oh, it's an app. Oh yeah. Sorry. I thought you were saying something else.
But what's, you know, Pro Tools, that works a bit like a 16 track or something, right? But Ableton has this, I don't use it much myself, but it has this sort of live mode, this kind of grid view, and you could just put these loops in and like arrange it how you want, and you'll be like, okay, we have these keys here, this like drum loop here, and you can sort of just keep selecting things, and maybe that's the composition, you know. But they did that first on Britches Brew.
Britches Brew.
The jazz pants. Britches Boo Boo. Yeah.
But yeah, I hearing 19 edits, and then it's just like you say, it's like literally, it's like there's this amazing video of Stevie Wonder at Abbey Road using a really early drum machine. And it's kind of like people see that and they're like, oh, that's the beginning of like how music is made. But no, it's like you have to go back.
Yeah, that's 2000 late by then, man.
And you have to look at this, and it's literally 19 edits on one song, 19 rolls of tape. And then you're talking about literally putting in and like loops. Like this guy's the, what do you call it? This guy's the splice of 1970.
Cause he's splicing for real. I know, not a lot of people my age know the kind of etymology of that word, but you know, obviously you had to like cut tape with a knife and glue it together. Oh, yeah. That's splicing. Cool.
You had a little machine, not a powered machine, but you'd lay the tape in, and it would lay it nice and flat, and it would have a little light under it sometimes, or just a nice little registration mark, and you would pull this thing down, and it would click like a stapler, and then you pulled it over to another machine, and then you could join them, and then sometimes people would still be joining with tape and stuff like that at that time.
People on here are doubting how you even heard a splice. I mean, from what I know, I mean, you were a big tape guy. You're always Googling that kind of stuff.
I go, huh? Someone say splice? I thought someone was talking about tape. You know, I'm in these discords with these hyper poppers talking about splice this, splice that, umru snare. They're speaking a different language. You know, yeah. I don't know what they're saying. So I come to you, I hit you on the phone, I go, AG, I got a question for you. What's this splice stuff?
And my phone's going crazy because, like, you know, I basically have the Heartbreaker solo on as your kind of like dial tone. And even if my phone's on silent or airplane mode even, it still rings with this Heartbreaker thing, you know.
No, it's a long.
So you're texting me, and I'm just hearing that Heartbreaker riff again and again. And I'm just like, but I'm ready to inform you, basically.
Yeah, no, you know, that's the beauty of this relationship. You know, it's a two way street. You know, we're jousting, except instead of holding jousting spears, we're holding guitars. You know,
that's the only way.
It's the only way. And that's, I guess, to go back to Bitches Brew, I mean, we're still talking about, that's that, I call it concrete music, the French call it music concrete, but that is literally, it's like, it's all of the stuff that is making up some of this new pop music. You know, you have abstract ideas, strange sounds, and also sampling and cutting and putting stuff in. It's like a perfect mirror to hold up to some of that stuff.
It's unreal, and it's still rock music, really, you know. That's
100%.
The thing.
100%. What were the three things we talked about? We talked about Bitches Brew, we talked about Band of Gypsies, Beatles Let It Be.
Now, yeah, I guess reluctantly, but it had to, you know.
I mean, we had to. We we had to talk about it, but with two very different, or three very different albums, but still all in that golden era.
Yeah.
Of classic rock.
But it still keeps giving, because the golden age doesn't immediately end. You know, it was then in 71. I mean, I guess you're getting nearer to the end of the golden age, but it's still going, like, super strong.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big Stones head, but I mean, we got to talk about Sticky Fingers, right?
Hell yeah. I mean, same. For me, the Beatles versus Stones thing, that's always been a no-brainer to me. But, you know, Stones, I mean, they're still going, you know, for long
time. Yeah, I don't know how those boys are doing it.
Imagine if you were a contemporary of all that. I guess you were, in a sense, a contemporary.
I was, in a way. You know, I bumped shoulders, you know.
But just to think of, you know, let's say it was like, you know, Stones versus Beatles, and the Stones are still going. So whatever you make of their output, I mean, they're just pretty much winning.
Especially when, because the Stones hadn't put out, because what, Sticky Fingers was what, their like 10th album or something?
Yeah, I don't know how you classify the early ones. You know, there's a lot more covers and stuff.
It's an absurd line of albums. And it's the year before, Let It Be, the Beatles' Trip Over the Shoelaces. Rolling Stone hadn't released an album in like a year or two or something. Maybe even like 3 years. It was something absurd. There was a huge pause. And then came back with Sticky Fingers straight to the top of the charts. And, you know,
I never even thought about that. They're like comeback once the Beatles have fallen apart.
Really?
I mean, that's brutal. That's like Mortal Kombat level, you know. That's a video game, but like, you know, like that's just a brutal kind of...
There are bands like the Stones that are just well-oiled machines, you know? They can just go and go and go.
I mean, Mick Jagger is the definition of a well-oiled machine, surely, I mean... Without a doubt.
He is chugging along. I don't know how he does it at this point. But we're talking about 71. That's like prime. Like, that is literally, he is strutting out on stage. You know, he's got that attitude. You know, he's got the walk. He's got the talk. He's got it all. And they come through with this album that is just so in your face, so powerful. Starts off with what? Brown Sugar? And it's like, it's just boom, boom, boom. It's just such a powerful, powerful album.
And you know this more than me, but the way they, you know, the whole thing of there being a side A to the record and side B.
Yeah.
You know, so they open side A with Brown Sugar, and then they open side B with this crazy track called Bitch, right?
Which seems sort of...
Like, that's just anachronistic at this point.
I remember getting the album in 71. I go, excuse me? I go, what? I go,
exactly.
Huh? I go, what?
I mean, they hadn't invented the explicit content sticker yet, had they? I mean, seriously.
No, and if we're talking about, I mean, funnily enough, we haven't talked about the visual side of any of these, but if we're talking about the album cover, that's literally like a zoom in of his crotch, you know? Just like, boom. Deal with that. You know, that is like, that's powerful. That's that attitude. Do you think that kind of attitude is still important today as it was back then? Kind of pushing those limits of kind of that character in music?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm getting a little bit of mic feedback on my mic right now. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that.
No, it sounds good to me.
Let me get these techie guys out of here. Yeah, I mean... It's very influential and very smart for that time, you know? Like that song in the chorus, you know? When you call my name, I salivate like a Pavlov dog, you know?
Yeah. Provocative.
Yeah. I mean, it's a genius take on sort of conditional behavior and rock and roll, all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, seriously. And then, I mean, if we're still in 71, kind of have to talk about Imagine. I mean, the Beatles, sure, they fell off, but then John comes back in the same year and has kind of his, what people know him for. You know, this album came out, and obviously the song Imagine, but this album was just
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible that's going on at the same time. Like, I can't even. Yeah,
it's such a dynamic point at this in this stage in 71.
And it's the other side of the coin, isn't it? You know, you've got Sticky Fingers and this attitude, and then you've got, you know, John and Yoko, it's peace and love, sort of utopia.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing's about love. And it's also, it's about love in both ways, because I feel like a lot of people, when they think about albums about love, they think it's this kind of lovey-dovey, everything's fine, everything's... But the album is about love gained, love lost, you know, living a life filled with giving and taking and losing love. You know, we're talking about songs... where he's literally, you know, using this energy of you know, Paul letting him down, you know? And it's like, the band's gone, but he also has this new love with Yoko, and it's now he's, you know, what? This was his second solo? First solo.
Yeah. So, I mean, you were there, man. I don't know.
You know, watching it all transpire was absurd, but him just really voicing this... voicing this opinion on love in general, and then the same year you have this, you know, literally Mick Jagger putting out a song with the Stones called Bitch, you know, and just being this like high energy in your face kind of stuff, and then John coming through with some of these, you know, kind of moving and provocative tunes about love, peace, utopia.
It's crazy. I mean, I sometimes just think about that lyric, just imagine all the people, you know? I mean, that's...
It's something else.
I can't even do it.
It's tongue-in-cheek, you know? The line, it is hard to do, is very much so tongue-in-cheek, is the way I've always read it, you know? It's kind of like, yeah, there's no way to... You can't even think of all the people that you've lived and loved and interacted with in your life, let alone the entire world, you know?
I know, it's completely overwhelming. I mean, just imagine all the people that will die. I'm screwed. But maybe... I sometimes think... That maybe John Lennon could.
And it's also, I mean, we could talk about Imagine all day, but also we got tunes like It's So Hard. Like, that song rocks. Yeah. And also Crippled Inside, that song rocks. Like, it's like a love letter at some points to rock and roll itself, you know?
Oh, it's, yeah.
Really special stuff.
It's very meta. It's very, I mean... And just even him with that, you know, grand piano and everything, it's reminds me a lot of Reflections. You know, I think me and Hannah Diamond were listening a lot to Imagine when we were finishing that album, and I think there's a lot of parallels for sure. I mean, it kind of goes without saying. And I know when people listen to that album, they're sometimes like, oh, okay, yeah, you're listening to Imagine. I'm like, oh, busted, you know. But
yeah, you got me. Yeah. Did you have any other classics in 71?
Yeah, I mean, for me, a big record was, and I know everyone's checked this out, even though it sums up kind of classic rock for me, but the album Tarkus by Emerson, Lake and Palmer, you know, ELP.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's insane that the track it starts off with, I think it's just also called Tarkus maybe, or Tarkus Part 1 or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's just insane. My dad had it on as a vinyl record, and it's got this incredible album cover, you know, this
it's very surreal.
This animalistic tank, but I didn't know much about records at that time. I mean, I was just testing stuff out, and I think I first heard it on the wrong speed, you know, classic vinyl beginner. But it was great, you know, it was my first sort of very speed moment, and it was just so fast and so hyper and even more virtuoso than, you know.
Emerson is just, he literally like completely redefined what it meant to play keys on a rock song.
Yeah.
Like, it's a masterpiece, you know.
And you got this
people in this chat, I feel like of what we've talked about so far, I feel like this could easily be the most slept on, I think, with people in the guild maybe, or just people in general. I feel like a lot of the ones we've talked about are, you know, talked about a lot, but I think Tarkus, if anyone in here hasn't listened, required This is homework.
But this is why, this is why, you know, this is the golden age, because you can take any of these years, and I haven't managed to do it, but you might as well just listen to every album that was put out by every label in those years, because there'll be so many hidden gems, right?
I mean, it's almost more about the years than the music.
Totally. And, you know, like, it's just any, pretty much anything with these years, it'll teach you something. And I mean, I grew up with Tarkus, but for someone who didn't, it's just like, they can just see, oh, this is 1971. Yeah, of course I should check this out.
Put it on.
Yeah.
Done. You know?
But, you know, I mean, they were all like, you got the keyboardist, you know, Keith Emerson, and then Greg Lake, who's kind of doing a lot of roles in this. And Greg Lake, I think, was one of the vocalists on In the Court, the Crimson King, as well.
Oh.
And I think he's around, or maybe it's a second Crimson album. I don't know. There's a lot of parts over there.
That sounds right. That sounds right.
And then you got, you know, drummer, percussionist, Carl Palmer.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but
everyone kept up. I mean, it was a masterpiece. Like the power each, the control that each of them had over their instruments. It was just like, it was just unparalleled, you
but
know.
But it's also, like, it's just like the British scene as well. You know, it's these.
Oh my gosh!
It's these different guys who are all working on different projects, and that just, you know, I remember seeing in all the like album sleeve notes, like all this stuff, and like, oh, it's these names appearing again, and like, oh, Greg Lake sung on this, produced this, and like, that just really inspired me, and just kind of was a sort of. Also a blueprint for being a collective and for collaborating across albums. And I think maybe with late 70s and prog, it got a little too much. But in this golden age, it was like the perfect, perfect layering of like, of collaboration and experimentation without it just getting, I don't know, ruined by the majors or something.
No, of course not. And it's, I mean, you think about Keith and this virtuoso on these keys, and then also like seeing him throw like Hammond organs around stage when he was a young kid, and then, you know, eventually meeting Bob Moog and working with these like absurd stacked modular synthesis machines. You know, that's kind of when I put the brakes on for synths, but I know that you and everyone in the guild, you know, loves those synths. And just watching some of these clips, you know, at any point in his life, of him just playing these amazing pieces on all these synths and keys, it's just, it's inspiring. It really is. You know, it's a...
But in 71, it's still rock somehow, you know?
Of course it's still rock.
That's what I mean. It's
still rock. And then you think, it's like, what, same year was Bob O'Reilly came out, like 2 months after Tarkus came out.
Yeah, crazy. So
think that like that keyboard line, you know, it's like the groundwork for so many of the of songs like that.
Man, it's such a ripe, you know, era. I mean, I think of this era a lot when I'm doing like sound design stuff in general. I don't want it to be too complicated. I want it to feel like an intro to Tarkus or intro to The Who or something, or even Imagine. Like, I want it to have that visceral quality, that kind of simplicity, that kind of sound frequency that will sound good on wax, that clearly these people
are
aiming
for. Wax. It's all about 69 through 71. It's all about cutting stuff on tape. But at the end of the day, it's really just about rock. And even more than that, it's really just about music, you know?
Yeah.
It's really about the tone.
Yeah, obviously if we're talking about, you know, classic rock, it's classic music, you know, there's almost no separation.
Yeah, and I love playing around with that word classic, kind of, you know, because it's, sure, it's 50 years ago, you know, but really, we just mean, it's kind of like, it's almost, the words barely even mean, they're like lesser than the sum of their, or greater than the sum of the parts, less than the sum of the parts, you know what I mean? It's, classic, you can dance around that word all day, but I'm not even talking about old or from this or from that. You know, it's literally just, it's this perfect little slice. It's this perfect little era.
It's almost like exactly the sum of their parts, you know, like it should be.
That's,
you know,
probably
what I mean?
Said. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because now it's always this thing like, what is this made of? Where, how, what's the volume of this? What's the quantity? How, like, it's too much maths involved in even like things like genre and music and audio, you know, and just here, it's so clearly defined. And it's so, I don't think the people, the bands, the artists, the producers even knew they were doing it. It was just a reality of the time, but it's just so, it's exactly the sum of its parts.
Yeah, no, it just, and this is kind of an old music stuff, but it just sits. Everything is in its right little place, you know? Or as some people say, it's in the pocket.
Yeah.
It's sitting right exactly where it needed to be. And
just to be clear, like, I mean, it took me a long time to figure this out, but the pocket, like the click track, the grid, the software, that has nothing to do with the pocket. Like, that's, you know, when I was first playing, that was one of the things you showed me, even like, don't practice to a click like that, or, you know, maybe a metronome if it was like an OG metronome, but just, yeah, find the pocket, you know, and the pocket is playing music with other people, is being a collective consciousness, is riffing on that way. Yeah.
Close your eyes, see how it makes you feel for a second, you know? And then another piece of homework is watch the Purdy Shuffle video. You're gonna, if you want a better definition of the pocket than anyone could ever give, that Bernard Purdy, the Purdy Shuffle, you gotta check that out. That's how you know.
Unreal.
69, 70, 71.
We have laid it out. I mean, the evidence is right here for all the guild to see. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
I guess yes. We could end there.
I mean, yeah, once again, like, just thanks so much for not just, I mean, this conversation, I mean, we've had loads of conversations like this. It's cool to share it with a kind of guild in this way. But I mean, thanks for all of these conversations we've had over the years, and for kind of staying with me even when I was sort of, you know, getting into this sort of funny, purely digital stuff that I sort of had to kind of pull myself out of, you know. So thanks also for being there at the beginning, the middle, and the end, kind of, you know.
Anytime you need that little bit of an analog angel sitting on your shoulder, I'll be there. And anytime I need a little bit of a digital devil, all right, so, yeah, I'm going to look over and
I'm
hope
right
you
here, Captain.
Guide me through that Able, what was that thing called again?
Yeah, Ableton. Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty rough hand of Ableton. I'm more into, you know, maybe right. Logic and Maximus P, but, you know, I'm going to be that digital devil, the digital demon. I'm right there.
I'll ask that Umru boy to help me with the Ableton. He's smart with the app.
He hasn't listened to nearly enough of this kind of stuff, but his,
right, I'll
his
send
drums,
the
his drums show a lot of influence, and I have, you know, I can tell he'll get it one day, you know.
I pulled up some notes, I'll fax them over to Umru. I assume he has a fax.
Oh yeah, 100%. Have you seen that? I mean, his whole imagery, I mean, that's just,
oh yeah, he's a fax guy.
Visually, he's already old school, so he's gonna, musically, he'll catch up, you know.
Right, exactly. All right, well, the guild, again, thanks for listening to two old friends talk again about the golden age of rock and roll.
And thanks for everything in, you know, everything that the guild's been doing. I mean, this is kind of, I think tomorrow's the last full day of the guild, you know, before we kind of go into a sort of quieter zone, and this is sort of the last big, you know, golden age moment, really, which is very fitting. So, you know, I'm sure there's going to be many phases to the guild, in the way there are many phases in life, you know, but I think for what this has been, with the whole Apple rollout, I mean, yeah, thanks so much everyone for listening, participating. I mean, from the Battle of the Bands onwards, it's been way bigger and more meaningful than I could have anticipated.
It was really special. I was glad to be a part of it in any way. Thank you, AG.
Seriously, beautiful stuff. Later, Mrs. Star.